his shoes, setting them down without a sound. He undressed, then crawled between the gritty sheets, wincing with each creaking spring. He closed his eyes and slept. It was the middle of the night when she knelt over him.
"I thought something happened," she whispered, stroking his arms, his legs, his chest, and now his belly. "I told my mother I'd get the kids tomorrow."
Her hair whisked his face as she kissed his throat, his chin, his mouth. Clutching the cold bedpost while she nibbled his earlobes, he drifted in and out of sleep, and the glow of Luther's and the Reverend's eyes through an old dream, dark and speechless.
"I went looking for you," she said with a slurp in his wet ear. "The lady at the boarding house said maybe you were out of town on business."
"Lady at the boarding house," he muttered, his eyes opened wide.
"Yeah, or maybe at Marie Vermoyle's," she said. "Why there?"
"She's an investor," he said, pulling the sheet to his chest. "And please don't go tracking me down again like that. I told you before, this is a small town, and I have to be very, very circumspect."
She sat up and folded her arms.
"What's that mean? Embarrassed? Ashamed?"
"Careful," he said, reaching to touch her face. "Extremely careful." Her cheek was cold. She looked down at him.
"Omar?"
Her voice trembled.
"Whose car's that you drive?"
"One of my investors. I already told you that."
"Yeah, but the way you said it, I thought you meant some guy."
"Well, it's not," he sighed. "It's Mrs. Vermoyle, who as of tomorrow morning will be my very first franchisee."
"Jeez," she squealed happily. "Well, let's celebrate then. Come on."
She tugged on the sheet.
"I'm really very tired," he said, anchoring it at his chin.
You and her, you know, are you doing it?"
"What? For God's sake, child, the woman is an associate, a respected member of the business community, a vital link in my franchising network. Please," he shuddered.
"So, you could still be doing it?"
"Bernadette, listen to me. I swear to you, on my honor, Mrs. Vermoyle and I are not doing it. You and you alone are the only one I do it with."
"Yeah? Well, anyway, I wish I could be your first franchisee," Bernadette said, pouting.
"Well, you can be my second, dear."
"Yeah, with what? My good looks?"
He glanced up at the sound of a car slipping into the alley. The window swelled with light. The car idled a moment, then backed out.
"Who's that?"
"I don't know," she yawned. "My X-ray vision's a little off tonight."
He grabbed her wrist.
"Don't you be flip with me. Did you tell anyone I come here?"
"No, I swear. I said I wouldn't, and I haven't. Honest,"
she cried, pulling away from him.
"It's probably just the cops. Sometimes they check the back door of the fruit shop."
The cops. He jumped up and crept from window to window. He ran down the hallway and stood on the wooden landing. Except for Marie's car and a jumble of crates, the alley was empty. His heart was racing. The biggest mistake would be to start thinking everyone was after him. He assured himself that he hadn't made a false step in this town. Not a single law had been broken. This was his fresh start, the reason, the justification for every other fiasco. The old ways were over. Now he would do it with honesty and hard work. He came back to bed, apologizing and trying to explain what a bad day he'd had.
"I finally get there with the papers, and it's the night before the loan, and Mrs. Vermoyle goes and gets cold feet. It took me hours, hours. I thought I was going to jump right out of my skin. There weren't..."
"Omar," she interrupted, "how could I be your second franchisee? What do you mean by that?"
"Well, it would probably take a little juggling of the figures, but it looks like I'm going to make enough cash off Mrs. Vermoyle to maybe, just maybe now, eke out a franchise for you. Provided," he said over her squeals, "provided you can come up with some money. Maybe, I don't know, 50, 75. Could you manage that?
Maybe,
she cried, collapsing next to him.
But, of course, Mrs. Vermoyle can't know any of this. That, you see, is being circumspect.
I don't even know Mrs. Vermoyle, she said, but I know her kids.
What do you mean, know them?
He gasped as she curled close, her face in the crook of his arm.
I mean, I know who they are. Alice and me were in the same grade. She was always real quiet, one of those goody-goodies.
She slid her hand down the front of his shorts.
Not like you,
he muttered, spreading his legs.
Yeah, and her brother, he tried to put the make on me.
What? He what?
He kept trying to sit up, but she had climbed on top of him.
Yeah, but that was before I knew you.
She was licking his mouth.
So, how would I come up with the money?
What about your diamond?
He said, feeling it graze his thigh.
I couldn't do that,
she gasped, pulling away.
That's my engagement ring from Kyle.
Marie couldn't stop shivering in the bank's air-conditioned conference room, with its marble walls and high-paneled ceiling. Opposite her at the long oak table were Jim Hubbard, the senior loan officer, and Cleveland Hines in their dark suits, white shirts, and striped ties. Grunting from line to line, Hubbard read another form, which he passed to Hines for his elaborate signature. Hubbard glanced up at her.
Will Rini be here soon?
He slid over another paper, and Hines's pen scratched his name.
No, he won't be,
she said, trying to clear the nervous tickle in her throat. Both men looked at her.
You see, I'd really like to do this myself, you know, to keep my business to myself,
she tried to explain, squirming under their gaze.
I mean, I have a good job and my own car, and you can check for yourself. I just finished paying off the refrigerator, and right now the only money I owe is Dr. Yale, and really that's my son's.
It's out of the question,
Hubbard sputtered, gathering up the papers. He held them against his chest.
I'm really rather surprised, Mrs. Vermoyle. I thought I'd made everything quite clear.
He slid the papers into a folder, which he gave a sharp tap for proper alignment before pushing back his chair. He couldn't be leaving.
No, this couldn't be it. Wait,
she said, hitting the table as he stood up.
I need this loan.
You need a co-signer, snapped Hubbard.
Why? I've never once been late with a mortgage payment. You know that. That house is all I've got. I'd never let anything endanger that,
she said, her voice rising.
Now, Marie, Hines sighed. What can I say? This is the way we do it. It's the way it's done. This is the way.
He threw up his hands.
We know you're a good person, a hard worker, but the only income you've got is your own. Someone in your circumstances needs a co-signer. Someone who...
My circumstances? You mean because I don't have a husband?
Yes,
said Hines with a smile and a grateful nod.
Because I'm divorced.
She stared at him.
Well, now, not just that you're divorced. It would be the same if you were a widow. It's because you're a woman alone. And a woman alone is a woman in tenuous circumstances and therefore needs a co-signer. Someone who'll pay the bank if you should get sick or laid off or if you can't pay.
He took a breath.
9 times out of 10, it doesn't matter. It's really just a name on the dotted line, you know, to satisfy the auditors and all the darn government regulations.
So, in other words, it's like a formality,
she said slowly, taking care both to decode his message and show that she understood.
A formality, he mused. Well, I suppose, in a sense.
So, what you need is Rini's signature on those forms.
She watched his face, relieved when he smiled and nodded.
Can I take the forms over to Rini?
She asked him.
I'm afraid not, Hubbard spoke up. Bank regulations mandate these be signed in person.
But that way, she tried to explain, he won't have to close up the store, and I won't have to take time off work to come back, and you won't have to take up any more...
Well, hell, what's the harm?
Hines interrupted with a sour glance at the peaked Hubbard.
Just drive around the block a minute, Marie told Omar. Go slow now. she muttered as she signed Renee LaChance on both documents.
It's just a formality, she said, uneasy with his silence. Besides, it's not as if he'd even care.
When she returned to the bank, Cleveland Hines was alone in the conference room. With Hubbard gone, something had changed. Hines seemed more subdued, distracted. Had it occurred to him that she might have forged Renee's name? Forgery. The word's reality stung her cheeks. Hubbard was probably calling Renee right now. Then he'd call the police. She held her breath as Hines glanced at the forms. The check was being prepared, he'd said in a soft voice. If she had to get to work, she could pick it up later.
Later. He was obviously stalling for time. Oh, God, she never should have done it. What had she been thinking of? If she could only get the forms back, she'd rip them up and never do anything like this again. I'll wait, if you don't mind, she said in a small voice.
Mind? Heavens, no. It'll give me a chance to find out how things have been going for you lately.
Oh, pretty good.
That's all? Just pretty good?
He smiled and slid the forms into the folder.
Very good, actually, she said, relieved to see him push aside the folder. Now, with the refrigerator paid off and the car's running okay,
she knocked on the tabletop.
And the two oldest have jobs this summer, Norm and Alice, and Benji's taking swimming lessons. He's always been afraid of water. Mr. Briscoe wants to take him fishing. He's such a nice man, such a good businessman.
She was beginning to babble with his eyes boring into her like this.
I couldn't ask for a better boss.
That's good to hear. But how are things with you? I mean, with you personally, Marie.
Everything's fine, she said stiffly.
I know it must be difficult with three children, but do you ever go out?
She froze. She had been right. This was a trap.
You're a very interesting woman, Hines said.
He kept smiling at her, trying to give her time to confess, to stop this fraud before it went any further.
You know, Renee didn't really read any of those papers, she blurted, gesturing at the folder. Maybe I should take them back and tell him to read them. I really rushed him. I've had so much on my mind lately.
Hines chuckled.
About the most women I know ever have on their minds is a hat.
He reached across the table and patted her hand.
The papers are fine, he whispered. Don't worry about them.
I just want everything to be done right, she said, not moving.
His hand covered hers.
And I just want to get to know you better, Marie. How do you feel about that?
He stared at her. Well, I'm awfully busy and...
Shocked, she pulled away her hand.
And you're married.
Not just married, but my God, married to Nora Cushing, who'd been engaged to Sam. His cool gaze warmed with amusement.
And I'm a very nice man, too, and a very good businessman.
He grinned.
We'll have a lot to talk about.
Omar hadn't wanted to take her check from the bank, but she was glad she'd insisted. $1,000 had obviously snagged Roy Gold's attention. For the last 3 days, Omar had been in Connecticut, where Gold was giving him a personal run-through of the whole operation from top to bottom. Marie was cooking dinner when Omar called to say he'd have to spend at least one more day there.
He's showing me everything,
Omar said.
The plant, executive offices, his suite, the distribution.
What's that?
She interrupted, straining to hear.
What? I don't hear anything.
Sounds like a little kid crying.
Must be crossed lines again. You really ought to have your phone checked. For all you know, somebody's listening in on your calls.
But all they keep hearing is me being stood up again.
She laughed uneasily. He had promised to come to dinner tonight with the paperwork for her two franchises.
I wish you could see this, Marie. The people here just hanging on my every word.
Omar whispered into the phone.
I should hope so, with all the money you're giving them.
All your money, she expected him to say.
Well, this is a different element now,
he said with the hushed urgency of a reporter calling from the midst of some tumultuous event.
These are the men that make the world turn, and they don't do it with small talk.
Are you coming back tomorrow?
I hope so. There's so much to learn. I can't keep all the different solvents straight, much less all the new business terms,"
he said. In the background, there was a woman's sudden laugh. "Where are you calling from?" she asked, hating the shrillness that betrayed her fear, her certainty that in the end no man could be trusted because she herself was so inadequate.
"Somebody's office. I'm not sure whose. I've met so many different people."
"What's the number there?"
"I'm not sure. Let me see here."
In the pause came a rustling sound.
"Well, I'll be. It doesn't say. That's strange."
"There must be a phone in another office," she said, her temples pulsing with the old dread. He seemed so far away. When Sam was drinking, she never knew where he was.
"They're all locked, though."
"Where are you staying?"
"Tonight, I'm not sure. I couldn't get my room back at the motel." "Why, Marie? Did something happen? Is anything wrong? Is anyone looking for me? Do you want me to come back? I'll tell Gold some other—"
"No. Oh, no, no, don't. Don't change anything. Just do what you have to."
"I miss you,"
he said. Her eyes filled with tears. "I miss you, too," she said, looking up as Norm's bright whistle carried down the street. She quickly removed Omar's place setting from the table. At dinner, Norm had seconds of everything, but Benji only picked at his food. He kept glancing at Omar's empty chair. Norm was telling them how every time Joey Selden complained about his popcorn stand, Jarden Green made sure he accompanied the laborer who would be repairing it. Aside from these tales about Green, Norm seldom complained about his job anymore. He liked his work crew, especially his foreman, Kenny Doyle. She could see how much he enjoyed not having Omar here. He had the floor to himself again. "When something breaks, like today it was the whole front counter, Green says don't rip it out, just nail a new board over it." A car pulled into the driveway, and Benji looked toward the door. Outside, Harvey Klubach was clapping his hands, calling the dog. "What's the matter, Benji?"
"Nothing," he shrugged.
"One of these days you'll go up and find the whole thing boarded up," Norm was saying. "Just this little hole for Joey to stick his hand through."
He plopped more mashed potatoes onto his plate. Tanned and with his hair streaked blonde from the sun, he was becoming a handsome young man, she thought. Now, when he came into the office, Astrid flirted with him. Compared to his brother, Benji looked peaked, almost sickly. Last night he'd run downstairs after another one of his nightmares. She'd found him on the couch, watching television with all the lights on. He pushed back his plate now. He had hardly eaten. "Omar called," she said, watching Benji. "He's coming back tomorrow."
"He is?"
Benji grinned. "He has to spend another day with the company president." Repeating everything he'd said made her so happy she felt lightheaded. "They've got all these solvents, and each one has its own ingredients, and Omar has to learn what's in each one, the chemical names." He hadn't actually said this, but she was sure it was true. Norm had been looking at her.
"Where is this soap place?"
"Connecticut," she said, pushing Benji's plate back. "Come on, Benji, finish up."
She snapped her fingers, and Benji picked up his fork.
"Didn't he say where in Connecticut?"
Norm asked.
"Hartford,"
she lied, rather than admit she still didn't know.
"How'd he get there?"
Norm asked.
"On the bus."
"The bus. Boy, that must really impress everyone."
Norm laughed as he reached for the last slice of bread.
"Of course, he probably said it's his own private greyhound."
She folded her hands over her plate and took a deep breath.
"They took his car, Norm. It's not his fault,"
Benji said quickly, looking between the two of them.
"Yeah, that's his story," Norm said.
"No, it's true. They did. They were looking for him. There was this old Negro man with white, white hair, and the other one, he was young, and they were driving Omar's station wagon. They were."
"When?" she and Norm both asked.
"That day, when he came."
Benji's eyes darted between them.
"What do you mean, white, white hair? How do you know?"
Norm asked the very thing she was wondering.
"I guess Omar told me,"
Benji shrugged.
"I don't know. Maybe I just thought so because he said one of them was real old, remember? He said that."
She looked away.
She hated seeing him squirm like that, his shirt collar hanging off his bony shoulder, his eyes cornered and miserable because Norm had caught him trying to defend Omar.
"I saw Uncle Reenie today," Benji said quickly. "He bought me a piece of cake."
"Uncle Reenie," Norm said. "Don't tell me you're hanging out with him now."
"No. I went to see his cat, but his sign said he'd be back at 2, and it was almost 2, so I walked down to the luncheonette."
2? She snapped.
"But don't your swimming lessons start at 1:45?
She watched him shrink into the chair.
"Did you have a swimming lesson today?"
He stared at the table.
"Did you?"
"No."
"How many lessons have you had so far?"
He shrugged. She watched him.
"You never signed up, did you? You lied to me. Benji, come here," she said, gesturing.
"Shit," Norm muttered, pushing his plate away. Wincing, Benji stood in front of her. She put her hands on his sweaty shoulders and could feel the same caged tension as in his father's bones.
"What are you so afraid of?" she asked, struggling to stay calm. "I wouldn't let anything happen to you."
She blamed herself for their fears. They had seen her hope for too long for Sam's recovery. With each birth, each new job, the separation, the divorce, with her tears, with her love, and with every denial, she had continued to plumb him, sinking deeper each time in the search for his decency, his strength, his love, drowning, pulling her children after her, instructing them not with words but with example and the tenacity of her hope that if they loved him enough, if they were patient enough, if they were good enough and kind enough and forgiving enough, then he would not drink again. He would mend his life and theirs. But she was beyond that now, beyond believing in broken things. Her future extended past this narrow yard, this town, those mountains. Omar had brought her the world. He had been places, seen things. He knew people. He was making her feel young again and whole. Less and less this sexless man-woman. Every day she grew more conscious of the weight of her breasts, her firm thighs and slim hips, along with this longing, this ache in her heart and her belly. The next day his mother picked him up on her lunch break, and they rode in silence to the municipal pool, which stood higher than the road, a colossal bowl of blue water, deep, deep blue water. Benji hadn't slept most of last night, dreading this very moment. His mother in her wrinkled skirt, her worn brown pumps skimming over the slimy concrete to Mr. Tuck, who sat behind the counter on a tall metal stool, purveyor of the hundreds of mesh baskets in the wall grid behind him. Each basket held a swimmer's clothes. Down here, below the pool, the air reeked of mildew and rancid sneakers. His mother leaned over the counter and said she wanted to sign him up for lessons. That would be 25 cents a day, Mr. Tuck explained. 15 cents for the lesson and 10 cents basket rental. She glanced at Benji, who was wearing his bathing suit under his pants.
You don't need a basket, do you?
He needs one,
sighed Mr. Tuck, as he removed an empty basket and set it on the counter.
But he's already got his suit on. I can take his clothes with me, she said.
Benji looked at her. Didn't she care that he'd have to walk the 3 miles home in a wet bathing suit with no shirt on? No, she wouldn't. He could see that.
His sneakers, Mr. Tuck smirked. Or is he going to go home barefoot?
He was a teacher. During the summer, he ran the pool.
I didn't even think of that,
Marie said with a nervous laugh as she gave him a dime. 3 girls had just come in. They waited as Mr. Tuck handed Benji his numbered metal disc that matched the number on his basket. The disc was clipped to a big safety pin that attached to his bathing suit. Mr. Tuck explained that if the disc fell off in the water, he'd have to keep swimming around the bottom of the pool until he found it, or else he wouldn't get his clothes back. Benji fastened his pin, and then he couldn't stop checking it.
Intermediate?
Mr. Tuck was flipping through the water-curled pages of the lesson book.
He can't swim at all, his mother said. He's afraid of water,
she added in a voice that echoed off the damp concrete walls. Afraid of water, water, water.
He's afraid of water,
hissed the little girl behind him.
Shh,
said her older sister.
Beginner, then.
Mr. Tuck turned a page.
Vermoil,
he repeated when Marie gave him the name.
You work at Briscoe's, don't you?
He asked, extending his hand.
Dave Tuck. Ferd Briscoe's my wife's uncle, her mother's brother.
Benji's hair stood on end. Mr. Briscoe, who wanted to take him out on the lake fishing, just happened to be related to Mr. Tuck. It was some kind of weird water conspiracy, and his mother was part of it. Mr. Tuck grinned at him, and he tried to smile back. As he went through the showers on his way to the pool, he could hear Mr. Tuck calling after his mother.
Don't worry. He's in good hands. We'll take care of him. Have him swimming like a fish.
The water in the crowded pool churned with twisting, flipping, glistening bodies. The announcement came over the loudspeaker that the beginner's lessons were starting, but Benji didn't move. He sat on the lower pipe railing with his arms looped over the hot top rail so no one could push him in like they'd done last year. He watched the lessons from his perch, and when they were over, he ran all the way home. Omar didn't come for dinner that night or the next. Marie's face was drawn and her hands shook as she put milk on the table. When Norm asked where Omar was, she turned back to the stove, whipping the potatoes to a gluey thickness. How did the swimming go? She asked while they ate. Good, Benji said. She nodded and said no more except for sighs that ended in little cries that gouged so many pieces from his own heart that his chest began to ache. Every time the phone rang, he saw how still she sat, how she seemed to stop breathing. Omar hadn't called in days. It was late, and Benji couldn't sleep. The moonlit night was ripe with the smell of skunk, and from a nearby street a dog howled. At midnight, Norm came home with Alice. Downstairs, chairs scraped over the floor, and the refrigerator opened and closed. Glasses and milk bottles rattled on the counter. In his bed, Benji sniffed hungrily at the hamburger and French fries that Alice was smuggling out nightly for Norm. They whispered and laughed softly together. The toilet flushed. Water splashed. Again the toilet flushed. Pipes clanged in the walls. The lights went out. For a time there was quiet, and then he heard muffled sobs from the next room.
Oh, God, his mother wept. What am I going to do? Help me! Please help me!
A week had passed with no word from Omar. Benji went to the pool every day, paid his money, then twined himself around the hot railing, watching until the lesson was over. His mother had finally stopped asking about the lessons, so on Thursday he didn't go. Tonight, when supper was over, she said she wanted him to go for a walk with her. She walked quickly and hardly spoke to him. He was convinced that she'd found out about the lessons and was taking him up to the pool, where she'd probably push him into the deep end and make him swim back. As they came along Main Street, she kept staring ahead toward the distant boarding house where the old woman, May Mayo, was sitting on the porch. His mother stopped and asked if Mr. Duval was home. She was smiling, but Benji could see the cords tighten in her neck as May Mayo said she hadn't seen Mr. Duval in almost 2 weeks now, but that she'd certainly tell him Mrs. Vermoyle was looking for him. Yes, just as soon as she heard from him. Which better be soon, she whispered as she leaned over the rail. He's only paid up 3 more days, and my sister doesn't much like him, you know. She says he's a fast-talking salesman, and Claire hates salesmen, you know. They turned the corner and headed back home.
If he doesn't come back, I don't know what I'll do, she gasped, quickly covering her mouth.
She began to walk so fast he had trouble keeping up with her. Later, he heard cries from her room.
Oh, my God, he's never coming back, she sobbed,
and he lay in his bed crying, too. Something terrible had happened to Omar, and without him, something terrible would happen to his mother. His mother was late for work, and the car keys were missing. Norm had already searched the house for them, and now he was outside on his hands and knees looking under the car. Alice had just come downstairs in her nightgown. She was positive she could remember Norm carrying the keys into the house last night. We sat here and ate, she said, yawning as she sagged into a chair at the table. Marie stood in the kitchen doorway in her slip while she brushed her teeth, telling them through the foamy toothpaste dribbling down the corners of her mouth that here she was, late for work again because of their carelessness. She spit into the sink, then threw down her toothbrush. How the hell would they like it if Mr. Briscoe fired her for being late all the time? What would they do then? She pounded the tabletop. How would they eat? How would they keep a roof over their heads?
Mom, Alice said, please, Mom, don't. You're going to hurt yourself.
And then I can't work, right? And that's all you care about, isn't it?
No, Mom,
Alice said. That's all any of you care about. I'm just a workhorse. That's all you think of me. That's all anyone in this whole goddamn world thinks of me. An ugly workhorse.
Norm came inside then and ran into his room. Benji pushed the cushions back onto the couch. He didn't know where else to look.
That's all I'm good for, isn't it?
Will you stop? Please,
Alice begged.
I'll stop. I'll stop when I'm dead. That's when I'll stop.
I can't stand this,
Alice groaned, covering her face.
I can't stand living like this anymore.
Oh, you can't?
His mother taunted in that voice that turned Benji's stomach.
Poor thing. It's just too much for you, isn't it?
Norm raced into the kitchen. He'd found the keys in his pants.
Here they are. Come on, Mom. It's not her fault.
Poor sensitive Alice,
she hissed, bending over Alice.
You're just too delicate for all this shit, aren't you? Leave her alone. Will you just leave her alone?
Norm flipped the keys onto the table.
I'll leave her alone. I'll leave you all the hell alone.
She picked up the keys and threw them. As they hit the wall, the chains separated, scattering keys in both rooms. Norm turned without a word and ran upstairs. In the kitchen, his mother crawled from key to key. She strung them on the chain while Benji picked up the ones that had landed in the living room.
That's right, Alice. Don't help. Don't lift a finger, she panted. Just sit there. It doesn't matter that I'm late for work.
That's not what's wrong,
Alice replied coldly from the table.
That's not what the real trouble is.
Benji punched the sofa cushion. Don't, he wanted to shout. Don't say his name. Don't say it. His mother grabbed the countertop and pulled herself to her feet.
What do you mean?
She asked.
What's the real trouble?
Nothing,
Alice muttered.
No, tell me. What do you mean, the real trouble? Go ahead, you said it. Now finish it. You think you know so much.
Alice stared down at the table.
You think you know so much about real trouble, do you? Well, let me tell you what real trouble is. Real trouble is killing myself day in, day out, all my goddamn life, and for what? So you can sit there with your snide remarks, so your lazy brother up there can fling the keys at me like I'm some piece of dirt, like I'm annoying him, so Benji here can hide out in the house all day and night, turning into a zombie when he's not with Clue Box, weird kid, who only comes over here because his mother wants to find out what's going on in this nut house I break my ass trying to make a home out of.
Throughout her tirade, she had been sliding the rest of the keys back onto the chain, putting on her skirt, tucking in her limp blouse, and now jamming her calloused feet into her shoes. They hung their heads and said nothing. She darted toward the door, then stopped.
I'm sorry,
she whispered without looking back.
Oh, God! Oh, God! God! God!
She moaned as she opened the door and ran outside. The car's riddled muffler roared down the street.
Goodbye, Mommy,
Norm called down in a sweet falsetto from his bed.
I love you.
Alice and Benji ran into his room and jumped on top of him. He tried to push them off, but they had him pinned under the blanket. They laughed and wrestled one another, arms and legs ensnared with sheets as they concocted an escape plan for their father from the booby hatch, as Norm called it. In the deep of the night, with blackened faces, they would cross mountains and swamps. They would scale walls. They would sling him across Norm's back and haul him out, beating off guards, nurses, and doctors. They would restore their father to power.
The king will reign again, Norm promised.
But what if Daddy doesn't want to come with us?
Alice asked.
We'll promise him wine, whiskey, and beer, Benji shouted.
And haircut money,
Alice laughed. All he has to do is get rid of Duval for us.
Death to the peddler,
Norm cried, shaking his fist, and Alice shrieked as the bed collapsed and they fell onto the floor. Oh, our papa, Norm began to sing as he lay on his back, waving his arms in the air. To us he is intoxicating.
To us he is so fine. Our mother says he's just a drunk, and we say we don't mind. Alice and Norm couldn't stop laughing.
But if Omar comes back, then everything will be all right and Mom will be happy again, Benji said, and they both looked at him.
Why do you always say such weird things? Norm moved away from him.
I don't always say weird things, he said, getting up.
Yes, you do, Norm said, as he and Alice lifted the springs back onto the warped bed rails.
Like all that shit about Negroes with white hair and Duval's car. I mean, what's that all about? How come you have to defend him? And what's this going down to see Uncle Reenie's cat? Jesus, Benji, why do you have to act so creepy?
The telephone rang, and Alice ran to answer it. It was their mother calling for Benji.
Do you know what I'm looking at right now?
His mother asked him. Benji shook his head. He closed his eyes.
Do you?
She demanded. No.
A note from Mr. Tuck. It says you haven't been taking your swimming lessons. And to top it all off, you didn't even take the first one, did you?
No.
Benji, I'm only going to say this once, so you better hear it right the first time. I'm going to call Mr. Tuck and find out, so don't try and lie to me, because if you don't go to that pool today and take your lesson, when I get home, you're not going to know what hit you. Do you understand?
Yes, he gasped, nodding.
By Jesus, you'd better.
She slammed down her phone. What's wrong? Alice asked when he hung up.
What?
Norm asked. And Benji shrugged.
You didn't go swimming, did you?
Norm said, and Benji shook his head.
Jesus, Benji, Norm cried with a backhand to his shoulder. Will you stop being such a creep, always scared of everything? Jesus Christ, you're going to be in eighth grade, and what? You're still not going to know how to swim. Come on, don't be such a faggot all the time. You drive me nuts. Shut up, Benji yelled. You make me sick. Shut up! I just want to puke sometimes. I said shut up!
Benji tried to push him away, but Norm grabbed his arm.
Leave him alone! Alice shouted, trying to get between them. She shoved Norm back and stood in front of him. The fucking little faggot! You better get him away from me!
Benji was halfway out the front door when Norm shouted,
That's it! Go ahead, run! Go find Duval, and maybe everything'll be all right again!
Masses of cold white clouds teetered in the sky. Benji made his way through the field with careful steps as the dog trotted alongside. The world felt cramped and still, and in its deadness there was nothing he loved, not a person, not a thing. Even the dog seemed heavy and menacing. Because of Mr. Briscoe, he couldn't hang around the store anymore, and now Mr. Tuck was writing his mother notes, and Norm thought he was a fag. Every day just got worse and worse, and now he was convinced that something terrible had happened to Omar. As they neared the woods, the dog began to run. At the tree line, it sat down and watched Benji's hesitant approach. Its tail thrashed from side to side. Benji stepped into the woods. The answer was in here. He knew it was. Something terrible had happened in here. There had been the strip of yellow and red cloth, the money clip, and now Omar was missing. Branches snapped and battered his face. Mosquitoes hummed in his ears. He ran now to keep up with the galloping dog. The dog's fur glistened in the sunlight, then disappeared as its blackness passed into the thicketed shadows. He paused as the dog bounded down the rise and through the clearing below. A crow cawed, and in the distance, pigs squealed. The dog came running back and sat waiting, its panting black lips split in a wet grin. He came slowly into the clearing. Even if he found Omar's body, he would never tell her. Instead, he would say, "He called when you were out," or, "I saw him down on Cottage Street." With hope, he would keep her alive. He would bring her things, flowers, perfume, a gold pin, a book of poems, and with each he would say, Omar left this for you. He said it reminded him of you. What else did he say, she would ask? That he loves you, he would answer tenderly, touching her cheek the way Omar would, or his father would, the way a man should, especially the man who would love and care for his mother. All at once now it came to him,
that it would not be Norm but himself who for the rest of his life would be making everything go right for her. Suddenly the dog sprang ahead, and he followed it into the muck toward the distant rooftops where dogs yipped and cows mooed and a red tractor rumbled down a bumpy road. Here the woods grew not with a forest's chance symmetry, but with an urgency and demand, thickened and enriched by denial, the ravenous wildness of encroaching trees that are continually sawed back, vines that are slashed and suckers lopped off, the dense cane hacked and beaten until it had all tangled and entwined to form this brambled green cave, skyless and vastly, vastly still. The dog snuffled through the undergrowth. The dog growled.
"Come on, boy. Come here,"
he whispered, wincing with every crackling step. For a moment, until his vision adjusted to the muzzy dimness, all he could discern were the dog's eyes shining back at him. Now the dog fell on its side and rolled against a long, dark log. With a laugh of relief, he stepped closer, then cried out. It was not a log. No longer a man, but a form, a mass of putrefaction, all the more inhuman because it was so human and so foul. A green vine grew across its chest. The red and yellow diamond shirt was torn. A trouser leg was ripped. One dark arm had holes in the dusty, distended flesh, and protruding from its chest that so strained against the shirt that it gapped at each button was the snakeskin hilt of a knife. This was the young man he had seen struggling that day in the woods with Omar. This was Early. The dog stood then and nudged the body with its head, playfully, as if to amuse Benji by prodding the corruption to life.
"Stop it,"
he hissed. Staring down at this face, unable to look away, he felt himself caught by the same expression of surprise he had glimpsed through the willow leaves that day, the day that Omar came, which, for this swollen mass, this creature, this man, this boy in the old man's worn photograph, had been the very last. And so, from then to now, had only taken a moment. There had been the struggle, the chase, the fatal blow, and now they met again. But for Early, there had been nothing in between. Again, the dog nudged the body. An arm moved, and in that quick stirring, the air seethed with a corrosion so foul it sent him staggering back, breaking his way through the thick entanglement. With the dog panting at his heels, he ran all the way to the street. A high wind swept through the treetops, but the smell stayed with him, in his clothes, his hair, his pores. The man they called Early was dead. But hadn't he known that? Known he'd been in here all along? Known he'd find not only Early, but the mystery of Omar Duval? Of course he had. Of course he had. His heart pounded with his running feet. It was over for them all. The worst had happened. Not theft or treachery, but murder. "We have come to this," she would moan from her dark bed. "Murder, murder, murderer." Without him, there was no more hope. And now, even if he did return, it would never again be Omar Duval sitting at their table or caressing their mother, but death. When he came into the house, the phone was ringing. His mother sounded relieved and angry to hear his voice. She had been calling for an hour. What was he doing there now? Why wasn't he on his way up to the pool? "I think it's going to rain," he said.
"I don't care if it snows. You get up there," she said.
Mr. Tuck took the basket with his clothes and gave him the numbered disc to pin on his trunks. A crowd of kids pushed and jostled each other through the showers. Benji waited until they were gone, then sped through, shivering and gasping as the icy jets of chlorinated water blasted down on him. He stepped into the warmer chlorine foot bath, and then he went upstairs. At least he felt cleaner now. That stink was gone. He was relieved to see so few people here today. To the east, the cloudy sky was quickly darkening. The wind had stopped. The lifeguards kept glancing at the clock. Benji hunched over the rail, praying for the rain to start before the lessons did. Now, with only the smell of chlorine in his nose, he did not have to think of Early. He kept his eyes wide open, knowing if he closed them even once, he would see that dark, bloated face. He had just spotted six of his classmates diving into the deep end. With only a few strong strokes, they swam to the ladder, then climbed out for the next dive. Jack Flaherty was on the board now, hairy legs and chest, the long muscles flexing down his back as he jackknifed into the water. 125. A cool wind snapped the flag. Two little girls in white bathing caps stood near Benji under the flag that said lessons. The sky roiled to a menacing gray. The instructor was headed toward them, swinging her whistle by its red and white gimp chain. He jumped up and started to walk to the other end. Please, dear God, he prayed for the one lightning bolt that would close down the pool. The heavy air tingled with particles of energy before the faint rumble of thunder. The lifeguards were already scrambling down from their posts when the first lightning split the sky. The two little girls screamed and clutched one another. Mr. Tuck's voice boomed over the loudspeaker.
The pool will be closing. I repeat, the...
Come on, Benji, called Jack Flaherty, looping an arm through Benji's. One last duck, Kenny Brown said, laughing, holding his other arm as they dragged him to the edge, pushing him, watching him fall through the 12 feet of bubbling blue silence. Arms out at his sides, he sank to the bottom. It wasn't the drowning, the dying, that was so terrible. It was having to do it in front of kids he knew. Early had died alone. He held his breath. His ears roared with pressure. He would sleep, deep in this watery place. He closed his eyes. It would be all right. It wouldn't hurt. He didn't want to hurt. After a while, Early must have welcomed sleep to stop the pain of that steel shaft so embedded in flesh and bone that every twitch or breath must have burned like red-hot metal in his draining chest, with Omar staring down at him. Omar must have seen the stricken eyes, pleading release, aid, comfort in that moment before he ran away. An explosion of thunder shook the pool and sent a shudder through his body that suddenly kicked and clawed at the water. A silver pole broke through the surface, and sudden whirlpools surged around him, with blurred, inquisitive faces emerging from the foam. He was rising straight up, straight up. As his head broke through the surface, the air seemed to slap his face with their voices. Benji! Benji! Are you all right, Benji? Up on the deck, Kenny Brown sobbed and rubbed his eyes. It was pouring rain as Benji clung to the ladder, gasping. There were lifeguards behind him in the pool, as well as lifeguards reaching to him from above. They kept grabbing his arms and legs, trying to get him out of the water. No, no, he grunted, struggling. He batted them away. He had not been drowning. He would climb out on his own. Blue Mooney knew Alice Vermoyle's route by heart. At 3:40, she would be in front of the church. From there, it would take her 5 minutes to reach the park and 12 more to get to the A+X. In the last few days, he had twice offered her a ride, but she'd refused. Yesterday, he'd even driven alongside, assuring her he was on his way up to the drive-in anyway.
No, thanks. I like to walk, she'd said.
But at least she'd looked at him and spoken pleasantly. It was a start. Today he planned to come walking around the corner just as she got to the gas station. Perry, the kid who was pumping gas, said he could wait in the office, but he had to leave his car down the street where Mrs. Bonifant wouldn't see it. He was sitting with his feet propped on the greasy desk when Perry came in from the pumps, wiping his hands on a stained towel. He leaned over the desk to see why Blue was staring out the window.
"Somebody owe you some money or something?" Perry asked.
"That's a curious nature you got there, kid,"
he said, squinting with his first glimpse of her hurrying along Main Street.
"Yeah, well, I can tell, Blue. You look mad."
"Is that right?"
he murmured, getting up to stand by the dusty window. He patted his wave flat and hiked his sleeves higher on his biceps. She was almost running. He checked his watch. 10 minutes late. Girls like her always made him feel this way. Nervous and unsure of himself. They were the kind of girl that needed to be cut down to size. But there was something different about Alice. She was pretty, but in a quiet way. That was it, he thought. It was the quiet, the softness of her. Perry was counting the money from his last sale. He put it into the register.
"When's your leave up?"
Perry asked.
"Not for a while," he said.
"You been home, what, since April, right? Ain't that a pretty long leave?"
Mooney looked at him.
Commandos get long leaves before special assignments.
What's the special assignment?
Perry asked. He shook his head with a rueful snort.
Be serious, will you? You really think I'm going to give some Hicktown grease monkey that kind of high-clearance, top-secret national security information?
Yeah, well, maybe I was just testing you.
Perry grinned.
Maybe I'm a double agent. Maybe these are all commies coming in here for gas.
Hey,
he said, grabbing Perry's arm.
Don't even kid, okay? I mean, this is a fine line we're walking here, if you know what I mean.
Sorry. I didn't know you were going to take it so personal. I'm sorry, all right?
He let him go.
Hey, it's the training, that's all, so let's just forget it,
he said, rubbing his temples. He had to be careful. The simplest things seemed to be getting out of hand lately. It was this constant panic, this festering sense of his own fraudulence. Of all people, Blue Mooney, who loved freedom and hated fakery more than anyone, was now trapped in a lie he could not make right.
What kind of training? Perry asked. In your head? You mean brainwashing?
Just forget it. Forget I said anything. Hey, so how do you like it here?
He said to change the subject.
Bonifant still a bitch?
Eunice was okay, Perry said, but the pay was lousy. Some guy said the tire company was hiring, so he was thinking of trying there.
J.C. Coulter?
He asked, and Perry said yes. Mooney cracked his knuckles. He was desperate for money, but he couldn't very well go looking for steady work when everybody thought he was home on leave. He glanced out the window. She was only 2 blocks away. The service bell rang as a red Mustang convertible with its radio blasting pulled up to the high test pump. Perry ran outside. He looked at the register. He didn't have to move from the window, just reach over and hit the right key. Apron in hand, Alice crossed East Center Street, then stepped onto the curb and raced along. The register drawer popped out, loaded with cash. Easy money, and the way Eunice Bonifant ran this place, she wouldn't even know the difference. Alice was crossing Terrell Street. Her ponytail flipped up and down as she neared the station. His fingers closed over the bills. Perry was propping up the Mustang's hood when the driver called to him. Perry ran around to look at the map she'd been studying. $25, $30, $35. Sweat trickled down the small of Mooney's back. Alice started past the station. Just then the corner light turned green and a pickup truck suddenly swung out of the traffic into the station. He couldn't believe what was happening. The truck was veering in Alice's direction. In a moment, a second more, she would be directly in its deadly path. There wasn't even enough time to get to the door. All he could do was bang on the plate glass with his fists. Perry and the women in the convertible looked at him.
Look out! Oh, Jesus, please don't! Please don't!
He was bellowing as the truck turned, just barely missing her. It pulled up to the other side of the pump. He was shaking. His fingers were locked over the crumpled bills. Opening his hand, he let the money fall into the cash drawer. Images kept popping in his head with flashbulb intensity. The truck, her bouncing ponytail, Perry studying the map. She was safe. He closed the register, certain it had been a test, a sign that she was part of some mysterious transaction he did not yet understand. She was already a block away. He hurried outside, chasing after her, careful not to call her name or say a word or make any sound loud enough to startle her, because she was running fast, and he was so close now that even the sound of his boots on the pavement might terrify her. So he ran on the grass strip between the sidewalk and the street, calling softly, "Alice! Alice! Alice!" until she finally looked back.
"Are you all right?"
he asked before she could say anything.
"I saw what happened back there. I tried to tell you. I was inside, banging on the window. The truck was coming right at you," he said, taking a step closer.
She glanced warily back then, out at the street.
"I couldn't believe it was happening," he said. "I kept banging. Did you hear me banging and banging like that?"
She looked at him. Her eyes were a deep blue, the lashes dark and thick.
"I don't know what you mean," she said.
"Back at the station, the truck. It was going to hit you. It was awful. I thought something was going to happen to you."
"Why are you doing this?"
she said, her face reddening.
What? Doing what?
The panic in his own voice stunned him. The last thing he wanted was to make her mad.
Why are you following me?
I'm not. I was out, you know, walking. I'm always walking. I love walking,
he said, trying to be careful that his wobbling boots did not stumble on the frost-heaved sidewalk as he hurried alongside.
Sometimes our platoon, we used to march 20 or 30 miles a day.
He looked down at her.
You ever been in Texas?
She didn't answer.
Real wild country, let me tell you. Tough men, real tough.
He wasn't making sense, but all he had were words to tether what was slipping away.
My sergeant's from there. His name's John Henry Nickerson. He's almost 7 feet tall with a tattoo of a horse galloping across his back. Most beautiful thing I've ever seen on a human being, and that's the truth. More beautiful than some paintings, even. The horse has this long, streaming mane, and Nickerson can make the haunches ripple if he flexes a certain way.
Her eyes widened, and he could tell she was regarding him in a new light. He told her about his own tattoo, a full blue moon on his right shoulder blade. Something in her quick glance made the tattoo prickle like sore flesh rubbing against his shirt.
Yeah, well, I wanted something original, you know. Not like hearts and roses and snakes. Especially snakes. Everybody's got snakes, you know, circling up poles or twisted around hearts.
The sharpness of her gaze saddened him. The truth was that it had been bad chemistry between him and Nickerson right from the start, which still mystified him because Nickerson had seemed like such a badass regular guy that he'd really thought all he had to do the first time Nickerson barked that ridiculous name Travis Mooney was to step forward and explain how really his name was Blue, which was what he'd been called all his life.
I hear Travis and I start looking all around, wondering where's the idiot with a name like that,
he had said, still rigid at attention.
Is that a fact?
Nickerson had sighed through a hard smile.
Yes, sir, that's a fact, sure is,
he'd said, flashing his most eager grin.
Well, I'll be damned. In fact, I'll be damned hog-tied and do-si-do'd now, Travis. But that's your name now, don't you see? That is your legal U.S. government-issue Marine Corps official and documented name. See? Right here. Travis T. Mooney. Travis T.
His hooded eyes rose over the clipboard.
Travesty. Kinda says so much now, don't it? For instance, it tells me that you are every bit a travesty of a man as you are of a soldier.
He'd had 1 week of soldiering, 1 week of Nickerson's constant harassment, one fist-clenching, tongue-biting week of insult and humiliation, until that moment with the fly-buzzing noonday sun on his back and the salty sweat stinging his eyes when he had Nickerson pinned under him as he pummeled the sergeant's face to raw flesh. For that he had served his 9 months, and now here he was, not on leave at all, but dishonorably discharged and sent home in shame. She walked even faster now as they got closer to the A plus X.
Hey, what's the big rush? You'll be rid of me in a few minutes,
he said, noticing how she turned her head every time a car went by. She didn't want to be seen with him.
It's just that I hate it when he yells at me, she said. The other night, he even pushed one of the girls.
She seemed so small, so fragile.
If Coughlin touches her,
he kept thinking.
If he so much as brushes against her.
He stopped and stared at her.
Look, if that...
He caught himself.
Friggin' creep ever so much as looks at you the wrong way, just let me know,
he said, pointing at her.
'Cause I'll break him in two, I mean it. You just let me know,
he said, his voice cracking with the same wild surge of emotion he'd felt at the gas station.
Oh, yeah, well, I guess I'd better get in there, she said, looking confused.
She hurried into the drive-in lot.
Just tell me,
he called, suddenly feeling foolish. It was a strange sensation to be standing here without his car or his bike, without anyone or anything to make him whole and solid, to keep him from stepping off the edge of the earth. As he headed back to the garage, he set each foot down heavily, as if to spike himself along the sidewalk. It was a hot, starry night, and even at 11 the lot was still jammed with cars. There hadn't been any breaks, and now everyone was tired and irritable. Alice hadn't minded the constant rushing and running, because the night had flown by without once having to consider what her encounter with Blue Mooney meant. She hadn't understood half of what he said. He almost seemed to be warning her, or threatening her. He gave her the creeps, the way he stared and stood so close, and now all his talk about snakes and hearts was a lot more weird than she could stand. At 11:30, she had just taken her last order, when Mooney's car squealed into the lot and parked behind the office. She pushed her slip through the window at Carper. Mooney swaggered across the lot, nodding over that peculiar gun-fingered salute he made to people he knew.
"Need a ride?"
he asked, standing off to the side of the window. Thinking he was speaking to his cousin, she kept tallying her slip. One more order and she'd be done. Carper's blocky head moved close to the glass.
"Alice in Wonderland don't speak to trash," Carper said in his high, thin voice.
He laughed. Mooney touched her arm and she jumped.
"I just thought I'd check and see,"
he said softly, hunching away from Carper.
"You need a ride home?"
"My brother's coming," she said, grateful that he actually was, so she wouldn't have to be ducking behind trees and telephone poles again all the way home.
Mooney slid something from his hip pocket and held it below the food-streaked steel counter so Carper couldn't see it.
"I got you this,"
he said, but she refused to look down. She felt panicky. She was conscious of people watching from their cars. Carper giggled.
"Here,"
Mooney said, nudging her with it.
"In case you didn't get a chance to eat."
The Hershey bar with almonds was soft with the warmth of his pocket, of his body.
"She's gonna throw up," Carper snickered.
"Thank you," she said, her eyes blurring with the heat of her red face.
"Some late-night energy,"
Mooney said, his square teeth flashing in a wide white grin.
"That's right," she said weakly. "Some energy."
She slipped the candy bar into her pocket and headed toward a car that was flashing its light for the bill.
"That's right, some energy," Carper mimicked.
"Shut up, blockhead," Mooney growled. "Just shut up."
When her last car left, she ran in to use the bathroom before Norm came. She took the limp candy bar from her pocket and squeezed it, then dropped it into the trash. What was it about her that attracted such weird people, she wondered. Mooney liked this time best, with the floodlights out and all the waitresses gone. While Carper cleaned up the kitchen and bathrooms, he and Coughlin had a beer in the office. The thin, frazzled man's filthy mouth amused him.
"How about you?"
Coughlin asked, handing him his latest batch of dirty pictures.
"Been getting much lately?" "No, not really."
He cleared his throat. He didn't like the way the pictures made him feel. He pretended to look through them, but he was thinking of Alice. Last night he had dreamed about her. They were in the back seat of his car, and his head was in her lap.
"So what's your problem?"
Coughlin snickered.
"I'm just here on leave, so I don't have all that much time, you know." "No,"
Coughlin laughed with raised eyebrows.
"I don't know. Not for that, I don't. Especially for that. Especially on leave. I mean, if you can't get it now, soldier boy, Jesus, you're never gonna get it."
He tried to smile. He slid the pictures back into the envelope.
"Hey, don't worry about it. I'm not."
Coughlin set down his bottle and wet his lips until they glistened like his eyes.
"You're making a move on that Fermoil chick, aren't you?" "Who says?"
His foot twisted back and forth on his boot heel. He pushed the pictures back to Coughlin, suddenly repulsed by them.
"I seen the way you look at her. The girls, too, they seen it." "I guess you're all full of shit, then,"
he said, getting up quickly before Coughlin's tittery laugh made him lose his temper.
"I guess so,"
Coughlin snickered. The door opened, and he was grateful to see his cousin waddle into the messy room.
"Here,"
Anthology said, tossing a mangled Hershey bar onto the table.
"Some sweets from your sweetie."
Howard Menke sat up in bed, blinking into the darkness. He had been dreaming the dream of the dead faces again. It was a warning, a sign of how much had changed. First the trips to see their cousin had ended, Now Josiah had stopped cooking his dinners. Instead, she brought him the pigman's leavings, mushy packets of carrots in waxed paper or cold gray slabs of ketchup-smeared meatloaf. They covered the refrigerator shelves, green beans speckled with congealed butter, a stiff pork chop, a shriveled baked potato. She didn't care if he ate any of it or not. It only mattered that she brought them home for him. He was losing weight. His belt fastened on the last hole now. He was losing his life, and his sister didn't care. He got out of bed and tiptoed into their tiny parlor, which was little more than an alcove. Its arched opening was just large enough for two easy chairs and the coffee table. On this narrow table was the statue of the pretty infant of Prague in his yellow satin gown and high-necked white cape. The infant's delicate features glowed above the flickering red votive light. It saddened Howard to see baby Jesus still wearing last month's gown. Josiah used to change the infant's clothes weekly, choosing special outfits for the holy days of obligation and their favorite feast days. The last new gown she had bought from the store downstairs had been bright green for St. Patrick's Day. The white cape had been dotted with tiny green shamrocks, and there had been gold piping down the front. It seemed that years had passed since March. Howard listened at Josiah's door, but he couldn't hear anything. Each night she got home later than the night before. In the morning he'd have to call her 10 or 20 times before she finally answered, and then she could barely open her eyes. She was always too tired for early mass, so he'd go alone. He'd sit in the last pew and cover his face, begging God to bring his sister to her senses and release her from the pigman's spell. He squinted through the keyhole now, and a stream of cool air hit his eyeball. The bed was empty. It was 3:30 in the morning, and she wasn't home. No! he cried, hitting the door with his fist. His sister, the only human being he loved, had left him. No! 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 Love had failed him. Prayers had failed. It was true. God did not listen to fools. Behind him, the apartment door opened, and Josiah rushed through the darkness. What are you doing? She cried, shaking him. What's wrong? She demanded. One side of her hair straight up in the air, her puffy eyes wide and fearful. He let her hold him. She smelled different. She smelled of fried fish and something else, something he knew but had no name for. It was a bad dream, he said, and as he lay down, tears seeped from his eyes. Now he understood. The dreams of dying were about her. He began to tremble. Soon there would be a night when she did not come home at all. The next morning he didn't go to mass. He made a pot of strong coffee and waited for her to wake up. When she finally dragged herself to the table, he tried to explain his nightmares. I told you a million times if I told you once, she said. You want to drink coffee all night long, then you gotta pay the sequences. No, no, it ain't got nothing to do with coffee, he insisted. I've been having these dreams no matter what, and every time I've been waking up, shaking and sweating, thinking it's me that's dying. But now I know. It ain't me. It's you, Josiah. You're the one. You're dying on me. She stood up and peered down at him. Howard, she said with chilling finality. I'm thinking about moving. For a moment, she seemed about to cry. Instead, she took a deep breath. It's time for us to be on our own now, she blinked. Don't you think? No. Father Gannon would not be put off a moment longer. He would meet with the bishop this Saturday. Saturday was best because it was the one day he had no hospital or nursing home visits. He had arranged with Father Krestecki to have one of his visiting curates hear afternoon confessions. The Monsignor poured more coffee into his cup. He picked up the paper, and a faint smile parted his lips as he read the stock page.
Mrs. Arkaday, he called.
She poked her head out from the kitchen, and he asked for a pen and paper.
8 5/8, up a quarter, he murmured, scribbling on the pad the moment she set it down. Times 75,
his mouth hung open as his breathing quickened.
At 3 1/4.
Glancing up, he caught Father Gannon's anxious stare.
What is it, Father?
He asked, pointing with the pen.
Jelly? Coffee? More toast?
You seem to be lingering.
Please call me Joe, he said. Is that why you're still here? We have to go over that old ground again?
The Monsignor sighed.
I just want to remind you that this is the Saturday I'm going up to see the bishop.
The Monsignor leaned forward.
Why, Father Gannon? Why? It's personal, Tom,
Father Gannon said. There was no reason for two men living together to address each other by titles.
Then I'm the one you should speak to,
the Monsignor said with reddening cheeks.
I'm your spiritual counselor, not Bishop O'Rourke, who, as I hardly have to tell you, is an extremely busy man. This is something I have to talk to the bishop about.
He would be firm. The Monsignor laid down his pen.
Then it's about me, isn't it?
No, Father Gannon insisted. Not at all, Tom. It's me. It's something I need to get straight with him. There was a difficult silence before the Monsignor finally spoke.
Does it occur to you that while you're devoting an entire day to yourself, there are people here, people in this parish who need you?
Well, actually, I'm doing some of that in the process. Pleased with his foresight, he smiled as he told of his arrangement with Mrs. Vermoyle to bring one of her children to see their father in the hospital. The blotches on the Monsignor's cheeks deepened.
Why?
He asked in a guttural whisper that seemed to choke him.
What could possibly be the purpose? I thought it would be good for the family. For your information, Father Gannon, Marie and Sam Vermoyle are divorced. They are not a family,
the Monsignor said.
Well, the children, Father Gannon said, groping, and their mother, they need... This parish has plenty of good Catholic families that need your attention every bit as much, if not more,
the Monsignor added. The afternoon grew cloudy, with sharp gusts of wind that kept snatching the water from the sprinkler and spraying it back at Howard as he weeded the flower beds. His wet shirt was plastered to his back. He knelt on the marble walk, weeding the snapdragons. The Monsignor was in the rectory, meeting with the Sodality Executive Committee. Mrs. Squireman's deep voice droned through the open window above him.
And so next year the four bake sales will be held after all five Sunday Masses.
Across the street, Josiah had just hung bath mats and scatter rugs to dry on the Vermoyle's porch railing. When he thought of her leaving him, his chest ached with this swallowed sob. The pigman was painting and wallpapering the guest room for her. They had already ordered her new bedroom suite, she'd said at breakfast this morning, and almost made him cry then. She would be a rent-paying tenant, she'd said, adding cryptically,
for now.
Whatever objection he'd raised, his sister had quelled it.
But it's a sin, he'd said. Then everybody that rents a place everywhere is committing sins, is that what you're saying?
What about Mrs. LeChance? He'd asked. You even said you and her been like sisters.
I'll still be working there.
But you can't walk all that way to work.
I'll be coming in with Grandine every morning.
But what about me?
You'll be fine. I told you, we got our own lives to live now.
Maybe you got one to live, but I don't, he'd said, angry with her for the first time.
He felt cheated by the pigman mostly, but also in a way by Josiah.
Grandine says you can get a room a lot cheaper. He says three places he hauls from got rooms to let, she had said without so much as a glance back as she crossed the street to the Vermoyle house.
He looked up now, startled, as a shadow fell over him. It was Father Gannon eating a large green apple.
Howard, he called, gesturing with the apple. You're soaking wet.
Father Gannon ran over and turned off the sprinkler.
What's that, some new gardening technique?
He laughed.
You work better wet?
He stepped closer.
Howard, what's wrong? Why are you crying?
He held out his hand.
Come here, Howard. Get up. Come on now,
the priest said, helping him to his feet. He would not look at him.
What's wrong?
The priest kept asking as he led him to the side of the rectory and sat him down on the steps.
Tell me what's wrong. Maybe I can help. At least give me a chance. Tell me what's wrong. Come on now.
I'm gonna be alone,
he cried in a high, stringy voice.
I'm going to be all alone.
Maybe you'll like it, the priest said, after Howard explained Josiah's plan.
No, he groaned. I won't never like it, I won't.
The priest stared down at him.
You probably won't, he sighed. Do you think maybe your sister would take you with her?
He shook his head.
She said we gotta have our own life.
Father Gannon slapped his knee.
Well, then, you're just gonna have to make the best of it, Howard. Look on the bright side now. You've got a good job, people who like you, people who care about you.
He had been shaking his head. His nose was running. Few people had ever heard him speak, but no one had ever seen him cry before. Ashamed as he was, he couldn't control himself.
But nobody loves me,
he sobbed.
Nobody, not even Josiah now.
Howard, Howard, people love you. Of course they do, the priest kept insisting as his fingers dug into his wet shoulders. I love you, do you hear me? I love you. Do you understand? He shouted. I love you, Howard. Oh, dear, came a woman's sigh from behind. The Sodality Executive Committee had left the rectory and were following Monsignor Burke down the flagstone walk to the driveway. Howard hung his head in shame.
Monsignor Burke loves you, the priest cried, pointing.
He darted toward the women. And all these ladies, they love you.